This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Greece okays debt concessions but still calls for a no vote in a Sunday referendum. President Obama announces reopening of U.S. and Cuban embassies. Smartphones are getting smarter.
The phone went off. I thought, well, that's kind of strange. And I looked down and it said, CPR needed. It gave me an address. And I'm going, wow, that's just short.
A musical celebration awaits America's big birthday weekend. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Debt-ridden Greece offered concessions Wednesday on its creditors' demands for more austerity measures. But Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras still urged his nation to vote no in a referendum Sunday on the lender's plan for new restrictions in exchange for more bailout loans. European leaders say that a Greek vote against the lender's plan would amount to Athens withdrawing from the 19-nation euro currency bloc, but Mr. Tsipras rejected that argument. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA's Ken Breitemeyer about the financial crisis in Greece.
The Greek Prime Minister, Alexis Tsipras, offered some concessions to the creditors, but it wasn't enough to get anybody to come back to the negotiating table. And then later in the day, he made a national television speech in which he urged his fellow Greeks to vote no on Sunday in the referendum on whether the country ought to accept more austerity in exchange for more bailout loans. As a result, it seems that we might be at somewhat of a standoff here for several more days with no new negotiations. The finance ministers met later Wednesday evening, and they decided it was no time to hold more talks. Let's wait and see what happens in the referendum, is essentially what they said.
Of course, Greece is trying to put forth some new plans, but they seem to be getting a lukewarm reception.
Very lukewarm. I would say it's that would be charitable to say that. It's more hostile than anything. Much of Europe seems to be fed up with this continuing drama with no end in sight, although the referendum is certainly going to be a key factor. I should note that European leaders say and have told Greece that a no vote is tantamount to leaving the Eurozone, the 19-country euro currency bloc, whereas the prime minister looks at the no vote, at least that's what he told his people Wednesday night. He called it a decisive step for a better agreement, and he says that Greece would aim to sign straight after the referendum a new deal. Now, whether that's possible or not, or whether there even will be a no vote, is unknown at this point. A yes vote, which is to say a vote against Tsipras' wishes, would probably result in a new government in Athens. It would be hard to imagine that the Syriza party would be able to hang on to power if the people of Greece don't want to accept his stance anymore. Mm-hmm. So there's much at stake on Sunday for sure.
Be very interesting to see how the people decide on this one, because the choices are quite large. If you're looking at leaving the Eurozone and going for a new government, wow, that's an interesting choice, I guess, depending how you are doing at the moment.
That's certainly a major decision for the voters. Probably most Greeks would say they want to be part of Europe. They consider themselves part of Europe, and part of Europe, at least for most countries outside of England and Switzerland, a couple other countries. There are 19 countries in the Eurozone, so Greece has an identity there, which would be dumped with unknown results mm-hmm. were the Greeks to depart from the Eurozone.
VOA's Ken Breitemeyer talking with Jim Stevenson. Banks and the stock market in Greece remain closed this week as an emergency measure to control financial turmoil. The Greek financial crisis continues to get reaction on social media. G. Abby Lee is here to discuss what people are saying about the Greek offer on the internet. Welcome, G.
Hi, Ray. Hashtag Greece is no longer one of the top 10 hashtags trending on Twitter. But that's because people are using other hashtags related to the country's financial crisis. The popular ones are still hashtag Greferendum and hashtag Grexit, which refer to Sunday's referendum and the country's potential exit from the Eurozone. The referendum gives Greek voters a chance to make their voices heard on whether the government should embrace or reject the bailout terms set by the European Union. The Greek government is urging its people to vote no.
Gee, apparently some people are trying to take the matter into their own hands in saving Greece from an economic meltdown.
Absolutely.
And tell us more about that.
Sure. So a few days ago, a British man named Tom Feeney started this crowdfunding campaign to raise money for Athens. I'm guessing his thinking was, if the big institutions like the EU or the IMF can't or won't do it, why not me? So Feeney used the website Indiegogo and launched his campaign for raising 1.6 billion euros by July 7th. A crowdfunding campaign is a way of getting your friends, family, and just about anyone else to donate for a cause through the internet. The campaign organizer sets a donation target and typically offers rewards to people who pledge to help reach that goal. But unless the target is reached, all the pledged money is refunded.
Well, that's interesting. So how is it going so far?
Ray, I'm so glad you asked that because it actually raised more than 1.2 million euros from nearly 71,000 people. It's also getting notice on Twitter, with supporters using hashtag Greek Bailout Fund and hashtag Crowdfund Greece. Although Feeney has yet to reach even 1% of the target, it seems like it's doing much better than he had expected. Ray?
Thanks, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
President Obama announced Wednesday the United States and Cuba have agreed to reestablish diplomatic relations and plan to reopen embassies in Washington and Havana later this month. Restoration of ties severed at the end of the Cold War is the latest move to end years of hostility between the two countries.
When the United States shuttered our embassy in 1961, I don't think anyone expected that it would be more than half a century before it reopened. After all, our nations are separated by only 90 miles, and there are deep bonds of family and friendship between our people. But there have been very real, profound differences between our governments, and sometimes we allow ourselves to be trapped by a certain way of doing things. For the United States, that meant clinging to a policy that was not working. Instead of supporting democracy and opportunity for the Cuban people, our efforts to isolate Cuba, despite good intentions, increasingly had the opposite effect, cementing the status quo and isolating the United States from our neighbors in this hemisphere. The progress that we mark today is yet another demonstration that we don't have to be imprisoned by the past. When something isn't working, we can and will change.
Mr. Obama said the best way to support U.S. values is through engagement.
With this change, we will be able to substantially increase our contacts with the Cuban people. We'll have more personnel at our embassy, and our diplomats will have the ability to engage more broadly across the island. That will include the Cuban government, civil society, and ordinary Cubans who are reaching for a better life. On issues of common interest, like counterterrorism, disaster response, and development, we will find new ways to cooperate with Cuba. And I've been clear that we will also continue to have some very serious differences. That will include America's enduring support for universal values like freedom of speech and assembly and the ability to access information. And we will not hesitate to speak out when we see actions that contradict those values.
The president said Secretary of State John Kerry will travel to Havana later this month to raise a U.S. flag over the first American embassy there in more than five decades. Mr. Obama must still deal, however, with strong resistance to lifting the embargo from Republicans and some Democrats who say he is prematurely rewarding a government that engages in serious human rights abuses. VOA reporter Jeffrey Young spoke with Thomas Bilbao, executive director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington, for his reaction about the U.S. and Cuba reopening their embassies.
I think it's a historic moment after 54 years of severed diplomatic relations. Today is historic in that context, but also important because it's a forced important step in the long process of normalizing full relations between the two countries. And having an embassy in Cuba will help the United States be in a better position to advance U.S. interests and the interests of the Cuban people.
Now, going into this, we have a little bit of cleaning up to do. We have, if you mind the expression, a bit of legal debris. We have expropriations that have taken place. There are frozen assets. There have been court judgments. What do we do to clear up all of this so that we can move forward and resolve these past issues?
Well, the first step is what was announced. I think that reestablishing diplomatic relations puts us in a better position to be able to work with the Cuban government to resolve many of those issues that will be necessary, again, for the full normalization of relations, including expropriations, issues of human rights, and others. But having senior diplomats present on the ground and in an embassy will help us be able to advocate for those positions.
Needless to say, there are quite a number of American corporations who have for decades looked at Cuba and wanted a piece of it, wanted to build things, wanted to open resorts, wanted to make investments in the country. And in order for this to happen, no corporation, no investor wants to go into an environment where their capital is not protected, their property is not protected. What does Cuba need to do on their side to make sure that these legal protections are in place so that they can entice development?
Well, certainly the Cuban government has already attracted some foreign investors under their current foreign investment law. But I think that you're absolutely correct in pointing out the many deficiencies, not just in Cuban legislation, protection of properties, of intellectual property, and frankly, the labor conditions by which U.S. companies or foreign investors are not allowed to directly contract their employees, but must do so through the Cuban government. And so these are many of the issues that the Cuban government will need to resolve in order to create a more favorable environment, which the Cuban government has already said is a priority to help jumpstart their economy.
And another important aspect, Cuba opening itself up to outside communications, opening up the internet, opening up the airwaves. Do you see this happening as a result of what's taking place with the opening of the embassies? Is this the next logical step?
Well, we've already seen that the Cuban government has already set up a few Wi-Fi spots and has announced that they intend to set up 35 additional Wi-Fi spots throughout the country at the government computer labs. It's also slashed in half the still expensive rate at which Cubans must pay in order to access the internet. But it's a process, and it's going to require investment on the part of the Cuban government and the willpower to deregulate, to decensure, and to allow Cubans to get access to the information that, frankly, is necessary in order to have a modern economy and compete in the 21st century.
Thomas Bilbao, executive director of the Cuba Study Group in Washington, talking with VOA's Jeffrey Young. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. The spread of smartphones around the world is providing the way for an intriguing new way to save lives. In certain American and European cities now, emergency dispatch centers send out mobile phone alerts to citizen responders nearby when a person needs cardiopulmonary resuscitation or CPR in a public place. From Spokane, Washington, Tom Bonsi looks at how it works through one family's story of survival.
Last September, Karen Garrison went shopping with her children at a small store in Spokane, Washington. It was there her youngest child, baby Nolan, stopped breathing.
It was such a blur. Someone yelled, call 911, he's not breathing. He was blue. And
the shopkeeper immediately dialed for help.
I don't know CPR or anything, and so I just was holding him basically until I was assuming the ambulance would arrive first.
At that moment, about a block and a half away, master mechanic Jeff Olson was fixing a car at the Perfection Tire Garage. His smartphone squawked to life.
The phone went off. I thought, well, that's kind of strange. And I looked down and it said, CPR needed. It gave me an address and I'm going, wow, that's just short.
A short distance away. Olson also volunteers with a rural ambulance crew, so he knows that seconds count in such a situation. He says he washed his hands real quick and dashed to the scene.
And so I asked her, you know, what's going on, what's happening, and then scooped the baby and put him in my arm and started doing some rescue breathing for him.
Half a year earlier, Olson had downloaded a free smartphone app called PulsePoint. The app automatically notifies users when there's a cardiac emergency nearby. It's tied into participating emergency dispatch centers in the U.S. and Canada, and soon Australia, too. PulsePoint was invented about 5 years ago by a fire chief in Northern California. Spokane Fire Department Assistant Chief Brian Schaefer explains the idea is for citizen responders to start cardiopulmonary resuscitation, or CPR, while medics are still on the way.
So the more responders that we can get there that can switch out CPR and keep that person's blood pumping until we have professional responders there, the more likely that person is to survive.
Earlier in June, the New England Journal of Medicine published the results of a randomized controlled trial in Stockholm involving volunteers trained in CPR and a mobile phone technology similar to PulsePoint. That study determined that targeted mobile phone alerts significantly increased the likelihood that cardiac arrest patients received CPR from a bystander. Schaefer says that since his department introduced PulsePoint early last year, the app has triggered an alert to citizen responders within 400 meters of an incident more than 150 times. Some percentage of those make a life-saving difference, although the chief can't say exactly how many. Good Samaritans emerge in varying ways and then often disappear before they can be debriefed and thanked.
Anybody can be a rescuer. It is that simple. In fact, traditionally we used to teach CPR in fire stations. We don't even do that anymore. It's all on the internet.
Similar systems to enlist citizen volunteers to respond to nearby cardiac emergencies have emerged independently in the Netherlands, Denmark, and Sweden. A new addition to the technology is to broadcast the location of the nearest defibrillator, so a volunteer can potentially get it and bring it to the scene. Those machines deliver a shock to restart heartbeats. For VOA News, I'm Tom Bonsi in Spokane.
Still ahead, music to match America's 4th of July Independence Day.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new is Google's self-driving test cars motoring around the roads of Mountain View, California. Google's Chris Urmson says if all goes well, these driverless cars will eventually save hundreds of thousands of lives.
If we can bring in technology that's always paying attention, that can see what's going on around it, that never gets distracted, this is a huge opportunity. This is one of these kind of 10x kind of opportunities to save lives and make the world a better place.
For now, the test cars will move at speeds no faster than 40 kilometers per hour, and a human test driver will be in the car for each ride, just in case. Along with saving lives, there are other major benefits of driverless cars. For instance, their ability to return home to park, waiting to be summoned by its owner when his or her workday is over.
When you start to think longer term about the impact on cities and the ability to reclaim space and to reduce congestion and free up parking, this is something where we can have a huge impact.
For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grosshans.
American ballerina Misty Copeland was named principal dancer at the American Ballet Theater, the first African-American female dancer to achieve that status in the world-famous company's 75-year history. The promotion for Copeland comes after 14 years as a member of ABT, rising quickly from a member of its junior company to becoming a soloist with a full company in 2007 at the age of 24. Copeland, now 32, earned raves just last week for a performance in the classic ballet Swan Lake in New York's Metropolitan Opera House. As the population in large cities change here in the United States, growth depends in part on legal international immigration. But in the Midwest city of Chicago, a decline in the number of immigrants over the last decade illustrates one reason the nation's third largest city is experiencing stagnant population growth. VOA's Kane Farabaugh explains.
For several years, Human Resources Director Pete DePascar says it's been a challenge to fill all the jobs at his suburban Chicago-based technology company.
Getting high-skilled people are still a challenge.
To fill those high-skilled tech jobs, DePascar recruits from outside the United States. About 80% of ProSoft's workforce is from South Asia. Many, including DePascar, came to Chicago on special work visas, known as H-1Bs.
There is a high demand for the H-1Bs, high-tech people. That is true.
While the demand for those visas remains high, DePascar says many who get them are not choosing Chicago as their top destination.
They are slowly moving towards the south, especially Texas and Atlanta, Georgia.
DePascar says there are many reasons why immigrants choose to live in southern states instead of Chicago.
The environment there is ideal for starting a business. Could be the taxes may be lower, and employers are getting a lot of benefits from the state government.
But DePascar says one thing that could bring new immigrants to Chicago is increasing the number of work visas that would attract the highly skilled tech workers his business needs. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Chicago.
Saturday is Independence Day here in the United States. Country Hits USA host Nikki Strong stopped by to chat with David Byrd about some of the tunes that celebrate America.
This week, the United States celebrates its 239th birthday. Country music is celebrating that with several patriotic hits, but Nikki Strong joins us in the studio. I want to chat about some stuff that people might not have thought of. Now, some of these are pretty obvious, okay? Some of them, like Only in America by Brooks and Dunn.
Yes, yes.
Where Were You When the World Stopped Turning by Alan favorite. Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
That's your favorite.
Yes.
Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue by Toby Keith.
That's also a favorite for a lot of folks.
Also American Soldier by
yes.
Toby Keith.
Yes.
But, you know, in thinking about this, there's some songs that maybe people didn't think of.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Aldean, Fly Over States.
Really?
It talks about all these states that people fly over and they, you know, and he talks about trains hauling steel and, you know, corn being grown
yes.
and all that kind of stuff.
What's great about a lot of country music songs is that they do paint pictures of American life.
That's true. And even Kenny Chesney's hit American Kids,
mm-hmm.
growing
mm-hmm.
up in little pink houses, making
yes.
out in living room couches. I mean, that's
yes.
me in high school.
Yeah.
All right. I don't
that's
know about
a lot of people.
I don't know about the rest of you all. But, you know, my girlfriend's daddy had a shotgun above the door.
Yikes.
So, okay.
We were Jesus, Sammy, blue jean baby, born in the USA. Trailer park, truck stop, faded little map dots, New York to L.A. We were teenage dreaming, front seat leaning, baby, come give me a kiss. Put me on the cover of the Rolling Stone, uptown, down home, American kids.
There's another one that I thought of, too, The Only Way I Know.
Mm-hmm.
Luke Bryan. That's the only way I, you know, Luke Bryan and Jason Aldean and Eric Church.
Mm-hmm.
talks about growing up in a small town.
Sure.
So what else we got on the list there?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there are tons. A couple of ones that I find to be interesting because they're kind of a little bit off the beaten path. One of them is The Ballad of Ira Hayes, which was a folk song that's been recorded by a lot of different artists, including Bob Dylan and Pete Seeger. But this version was the most popular, and it was by Johnny Cash. And it tells the story of a Pima Indian that served in the Marine Corps in World War II and was one of the men that raised the flag over Iwo Jima.
Oh, okay.
So, and you see the iconic photograph, yes, and only to return home to his reservation and lose his life to alcoholism.
Brantley Gilbert, one hell of an amen.
Yes.
That's a great song.
Yes, it tells a story.
You know,
yes.
Those are all, you know, they're not really jingoistic, like, you know,
no.
Yay, America, wave the flag.
No.
But they tell an American story.
Yeah, they do. They do. And I think that's part of when you think of country music and celebrating American life in all of its aspects and telling stories. And so my favorite country song of all time, well, not of all time, as far as celebrating July the 4th, is Alan Jackson, Where Were You? When the world stopped turning. He really captures the myriad, the variety of emotions that people experience in relation to 9/11. And even if you weren't directly impacted by 9/11, if you've ever been impacted by war, this song really moves you.
All right, that's VOA's Nikki Strong. We welcome your comments. You can check us out at VOA_IE on Twitter. Nikki is also on VOA_music
yes.
on Twitter.
Yes.
And you can also catch her on Country Hits USA by logging on to our website. That's www.voanews.com.
Where were you when the world stopped turning on that September day?
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While there's been much encouraging news about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in recent months, new infections of the virus continue, and the United States remains committed to doing what it takes to stop them. U.S. Ebola treatment units and basic response infrastructure are in place, and thousands of U.S.-supported civilian responders are at work to fight the disease. It's killed more than 11,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and a handful of other countries, including our own. Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, but is still within a 90-day period on heightened security for recurrence of the disease. New cases continue to emerge elsewhere, with 8 recently identified in Sierra Leone and 12 in Guinea. Cases continue in areas bordering Guinea-Bissau, and efforts to ensure that country is better prepared for Ebola cases are underway. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is conducting trials on various candidate Ebola vaccines, including a controlled trial on the effectiveness of one vaccine in particular. NIH is also testing therapeutic drug candidates to treat those who have been infected, working to improve diagnosis of the disease, which has so far required sophisticated, labor-intensive DNA analysis, and trying to better understand how it causes the disease. In other words, the United States is supporting a wide range of research on prevention and treatment of Ebola. Meanwhile, a partnership between U.S. and Liberian researchers is studying approximately 7,500 people in that country, including 1,500 who survived Ebola within the last 2 years. Health investigators want to better understand Ebola's long-term health consequences and determine if survivors develop long-term immunity that will protect them from future infection. They also would like to better understand how the Ebola virus can persist in some organs of survivors long after they appear to have recovered and the degree of risk that they can transmit the virus to others. While we have succeeded in controlling the exponential growth of the disease, getting to zero cases will require a sustained international response. The fight is far from over, and we remain committed to achieving an Ebola-free West Africa. The research U.S. and other scientists are carrying out now will improve the odds of preventing any future outbreak of Ebola from spreading, as the 2014 epidemic did.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email,
visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.